My name is Sunny Miller. We're at Trap Rock Peace Center in Deerfield, Massachusetts, interviewing Curry Peterson-Smith from the Rochester area. Curry is a student, and you've just traveled to Iraq, returning and bringing back your observations to share in service to the Campus Anti-War Network. Wonder if you could tell us, Curry, just a bit about the Campus Anti-War Network.
Sure. The Campus Anti-War Network is a nationwide network of different campus-based anti-war groups, college campuses and high school groups as well. I go to the Rochester Institute of Technology, and so we have an anti-war group on our campus, and we're part of the Campus Anti-War Network.
Thanks. And when did you travel to Iraq?
This was a few weeks ago now. It was, I believe, January 3rd was when I left the United States. And I got back on the 12th.
So in 2004, a trip to assess the situation on the ground. We're going to ask you, Curry, about any myths that you might have seen dispelled, the situation in the hospitals, the situation on the streets for ordinary Iraqis, the mood, and what the economic situation is like. I wonder if you could start with describing any myths that were broken for you as you traveled in Baghdad?
Sure. One of the things that I was interested to find out was what the invasion was like for ordinary Iraqis. We heard a lot here in the United States from different media outlets that regardless of your feelings on the war, you had to admit that the invasion was being carried out with surgical precision. The term surgical precision was used a lot, and that civilians were being spared, that Ba'athist facilities were being targeted, but for the most part, that if you were a civilian in Baghdad, you were all right. And based on some of the stories I heard, that's not true. The first Iraqi I actually spoke with when we landed in Jordan, we flew to Jordan because there are no commercial flights in or out of Iraq, and so we had to fly to Amman, Jordan, and then drive to Baghdad, and our driver, Tariq, was like many Iraqis who I would meet who actually wasn't opposed to the invasion initially. He said that Iraqis are very tired. They've been under 35 years of dictatorship. They've experienced 20 years of war, and it's been really devastating. And so they were hoping that the United States would get rid of Saddam, bring freedom, and whatnot. This is Tariq and other Iraqis I met, not all of them, but a good number. And actually, during the invasion, one of his brothers was killed. And so that was one of the first things that really turned him against the U.S. invasion and occupation.
How did his brother die?
He didn't tell me how his brother died. He just told me that his brother was killed. So
a painful topic. And the next Iraqi you spoke with, whom else did you get to visit with?
I spoke with others who lost family members during the invasion, too. This one woman named Vivian Salim, she was, I'll tell you the day, it was April 7th in 2003, this is during the invasion, and her neighborhood came under attack by U.S. bombers. And so she and her husband got their children in the car, and they wanted to leave the neighborhood, leave the area, and flee to safety. So they left the area, and they were driving down the street when they found a U.S. tank in their path, and the tank just opened fire on their car. Ended up killing her whole family, her husband and her three children. And she was able to flee. We spoke with her. We had a meeting with her, me and the other people on my delegation. And one of the people in our delegation asked if the tank had fired any warning shots. And she broke down crying as she told us that the first shot landed in her son's face. So that's... And I heard another story, actually, in the same meeting from another woman who lost two relatives to tank fire during the invasion. And they were Iraqis trying to leave areas, and they got cornered by tanks. Also, on the matter of invasion, I think it's important to know that the U.S. used cluster bombs when bombing Baghdad. Now, Baghdad's a city of 4 million people. You know, it's a big city. Cluster bombs, obviously, by definition, are not a humanitarian weapon by any means. The whole point of a cluster bomb is to kill and injure as many people as possible. and cause as much destruction as possible. So this had a horrific toll on people who were living in Baghdad. And I spoke with a doctor at the Qadamiyah Hospital. He's a surgeon. And he said that during the invasion, the single greatest number of surgeries he was performing was on civilians who had been injured by cluster bombs.
Mm.
So the idea that this was a surgically precise invasion in which only Ba'athists were targeted is an absolute lie. I think it's important to note, too, we saw the barracks of soldiers that had been destroyed when we were in Iraq. And it's you had soldiers who were in the military, didn't necessarily want to be part of the Iraqi military, but they were. And they were bombed in their barracks as they were sleeping. So the idea that this was in any way a humanitarian invasion that took care to preserve lives, you know, the idea that they were simply going after people who deserve to be killed, you know, if the U.S. even has the right to decide who deserves to be killed, there were many civilians killed, is the sense that I got, and many people suffered during the invasion.
The question of the legality or illegality of this bombardment and invasion, of course, will be discussed widely this entire year,
mm-hmm.
as there are challenges not only to the intelligence, the so-called intelligence,
right.
that the administration presented, but I believe there will need to be great discussion and discernment of the principle of preemptive strike. Corey, could you tell us a bit about what you saw with regard to the military occupation on the streets? The tanks are still there, of course, and we're concerned that the tanks fire a depleted uranium round that's going to leave contamination. You've said the cluster bombs were used widely. Of course, not all those explode, and that ordnance is left in both the fields and agricultural areas, according to Rick McDowell and Mary Todeschow, and I suppose in ordinary neighborhoods. I wonder just what Baghdad looks like now.
Sure. Well, it's clearly a military occupation. You know, there's essentially martial law that's being imposed through what's called the Coalition Provisional Authority, and it's clearly the U.S. military that's in charge. So it is a military state, without a doubt. On the other hand, Baghdad's a massive city, and so it's not like there aren't soldiers in every corner, which was something that I wasn't sure how it would actually look like on the ground. There are a lot of U.S. I don't know if you'd call them bases, but places where the U.S. occupies are surrounded by barbed wire and defended by tanks and fortified and whatnot. There are a good number of those in Baghdad, and that's where most of the troops are concentrated.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, there are patrols all the time, patrols with tanks and Humvees and other military vehicles.
And what are the patrols protecting?
In Baghdad itself, when I saw patrols, they were just kind of driving down the street.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't, it seemed as though they were just kind of checking on things. As we were driving to Baghdad, this is on the road between Amman, Jordan, and Baghdad. Actually, the first time I saw U.S. troops, there were two escort vehicles that I saw. And these are armored vehicles with big guns sticking out of the top and soldiers behind the guns. And it turned out that they were escorting a convoy of oil tanker trucks,
mm-hmm.
so, going toward Baghdad. And there were two other escort vehicles in the front.
Some of the
spoils. In Baghdad itself, when I saw patrols, they were just kind of driving down the street.
Uh-huh. I understand from your writing that the United States took over a prison that had been run by Saddam Hussein's regime, and that you were able to speak with people, someone who had been released. Is that right?
I wasn't able to speak. Well, first of all, this is the Abu Ghraib prison that you're referring to, and it's outside of Baghdad. As we were approaching the city, we saw it. And, as prisons do, it looked terrifying. It's a big kind of fortress with guard towers and razor wire everywhere. I wasn't able to speak to any prisoners who were imprisoned in Abu Ghraib, but I spoke with our itinerary in Baghdad was actually coordinated by the Occupation Watch Center. And one of the big issues that they're working on, they're an NGO based in Baghdad, that exists to call attention, international attention, to the occupation and try to organize on some level people within Iraq who are against the occupation,
mm-hmm.
And coordinate communication and whatnot. And one of the big issues that they're working on is the imprisonment of Iraqis in prisons like Abu Ghraib. And so they've spoken with people who've been in the prison, and they've worked with other organizations that are working on detained Iraqis. And so they have a good sense of what the situation is inside. It's pretty bleak.
What do they report?
They told me that the prison essentially is you have these fortified walls, and then inside the center of the prison is a big courtyard, and in the courtyard are plastic tents. And these are where the prisoners stay. And the weather in Iraq is, it's nicer than Rochester in the winter, where I am right now, but it's not a place where you'd want to be staying in a plastic tent. The woman who's in charge of the Occupation Watch Center, Iman, said that there's a saying in Iraq that goes, Iraqis are as crazy as their weather. And the idea is that the extremes in Iraq are pretty amazing. When we were there, it was winter, and so it would get below freezing at night, and these prisoners are staying in the plastic tents in the night, in the winter. They're also staying in these tents during the days in the summer, when the temperature exceeds 120 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, really brutal conditions to be staying.
Are there charges or any judicial procedures for people being imprisoned?
My understanding is that what exists as far as the legal system goes is you have the coalition forces, the U.S. forces, and you have what are called the Iraqi police, the IP, and they're supposed to handle civil crimes like theft and, you know, crimes like that. They also work with the U.S. military forces, though. And so there are some crimes that if you're arrested for those, you're supposed to be able to have a lawyer, and you can have a trial and whatnot. But ultimately, the United States has the final word, so people in the Occupation Watch Center told me that even Iraqis who have had lawyers, had trials and been acquitted of whatever crimes they've had, they were brought in for, the U.S. Army can kind of veto that and say, no, we're still going to hold you anyway. So essentially, you don't really have recourse.
Hmm. Interesting. So imprisonment it doesn't end when one is acquitted?
Right. Not necessarily.
Let's hear a bit about the health conditions. What did you find out about ordinary health care? What are the hospitals like? We heard they were in terrible shape after 12 years of economic sanctions. Just abysmal conditions, without electricity, without sheets, without sterilization equipment, and the cupboards nearly bare of medical supplies. What's happening now?
Before I get into what I saw with the hospital, it's important to talk about a bit about the economic sanctions.
Okay.
And that's in 1991, when the U.S. invaded Iraq through the United Nations. The U.S. and U.K. imposed through the United Nations what were called the economic sanctions, and that's an economic embargo on Iraq through which a lot of items couldn't be traded with Iraq. There are items that ranged from medicine to water purification supplies to construction materials to sheets, like you said, to clothing, ambulances, all kinds of things were not allowed to be traded under the justification that these were dual-use items. And the idea was that you could use chlorine to purify water, but you could also use it to make weapons of mass destruction. I don't know what the logic behind not allowing ambulances in was, but essentially this was an excuse to prohibit these items from being traded with Iraq. And so that's really, while the invasion, there's evidence of the invasion throughout Baghdad that I saw, bombed out buildings and whatnot, but the evidence of the sanctions is really widespread. It's like buildings are just falling apart because their construction materials weren't allowed in.
Mm.
And the hospitals, as you said, were hit especially hard by the sanctions as far as medicines go, but also before we even, I'll tell you about one hospital that we went to, the Katamiya Hospital that I mentioned earlier. And before going in, the surgeon who kind of showed us around assured us that this was one of the best hospitals in all of Iraq. This was a teaching hospital where medical students come to learn how to be doctors, and so it was one of the best hospitals for that purpose. And so we went in, and before we even saw the medical facilities, just kind of the basics, the hospital was clearly in disrepair. The walls were cracked and falling apart. The floors were filthy. The ceilings were missing lights and things like that. And so before we even saw the medical situation, you could see that these hospitals are falling apart. And it was the same with another hospital I visited as well.
And then what did you hear from the doctors?
They talked about the lack of medical supplies. This one surgeon told us about how he's restricted in the number of surgeries they can perform because they don't have the oxygen tanks to give people oxygen while they're operating on them. So they can only do so many surgeries. He just told us that they don't have a lot of the basic materials.
I think that we might want our listeners all to know that while human rights abuses were terrible in Iraq, the medical care provided to ordinary citizens was free. Medical training was given abroad at the best universities and hospitals the West could provide.
Right.
And this was all a great resource afforded to the Iraqi people because oil was nationalized under Saddam Hussein. Is that right?
Sorry, go ahead.
I don't know the history of when oil was nationalized. I'm not sure that it was under Hussein's regime, but that's my understanding, that there was not only free college education for anyone who wasn't a political enemy, mm-hmm. But this tremendous healthcare system.
Right. I mean, that's one of the characteristics of Saddam's regime was the public sector was very comprehensive, and a big component of that was healthcare. And what's really amazing and I think important for us to understand is that Iraq was not a third world country until very recently. Iraq had some of the best healthcare in the Middle East. It had one of the highest literacy rates in the world, actually. Their education, their medical systems were very good. And so this has really been in the past, really the past decade, that there's been this incredible decline. And economic sanctions prevented some of the most basic things. I mean, medical manuals, doctors are always have to update their knowledge of medicine and the body and whatnot. And doctors, under the economic sanctions, they weren't even getting medical manuals. And so mm-hmm. they were behind in terms of technology and medicine and whatnot. So
any medical students or physicians listening might develop an interest in sending some manuals that are just a little bit out of date, but not a decade old.
Right. The doctor we spoke with, and a few doctors actually told us about how they're trying to get medical supplies, which they really need. I mean, you have people share. We saw people sharing beds in the hospitals because there aren't enough beds to go around. We saw children wearing oxygen masks that were designed for adults, and so their parents have to sit there and hold them. We saw children who doctors told us, this child's going to die unless we get the materials we need. So it's really absolutely a horrific situation. And the doctors are trying to get more supplies, and they're going through the Ministry of Health, and they're saying that it's just a runaround. They're not getting anywhere with the Ministry of Health. The Ministry of Health is the ministries now are under the Coalition Provisional Authority, under the U.S. authority, and so they said that they've been absolutely useless in terms of getting new supplies or anything like that. And we actually spoke with someone from the Ministry of Health. It's worth talking about.
Okay, let's hear that. You're listening to Curry Peterson-Smith of the Campus Anywhere Network, who traveled to Baghdad, Iraq, in January of 2004. Go ahead, Curry.
Thank you. We had a meeting with someone named Saeed Haki, believe his name was, and he, right, Dr. Saeed Haki, and he is an advisor in the Ministry of Health. He's actually from Iraq. He grew up there, and then he left in 1983 to come to the United States, and he was a doctor in Florida, and he was recently brought back by the U.S., and he serves as an advisor in the Ministry of Health. And so we were asking him about the medical situation, how he saw that these hospitals were lacking the kind of the bare necessities. And he really wasn't helpful in terms of answering any of our questions as to why the medicine wasn't getting there, and what the situation was. And he even suggested that that some doctors are simply allowing their patients to suffer for the sake of making the U.S. look bad, which is, I mean, we met these doctors, and the doctors told us again and again how they don't see themselves as political people, they just see themselves as doctors, and they're there to save lives. And so this is really insulting to think that doctors would allow their patients to die for the sake of making the United States look bad. But this the person we spoke with in the Ministry of Health was clearly very much for the invasion. And for the occupation, and so he really wasn't helpful. But that's the situation that people that these doctors are dealing with, and it's really devastating for them to. I mean, these are people who they know, who live in their neighborhoods, who they're operating on, and they lose them because they just don't have the basic supplies.
Before we talk about what ordinary citizens can do to address this terrible situation, I wonder if we can just touch on the economic situation for ordinary Iraqis, shopkeepers, workers. What's Baghdad looking like?
Sure. And you know, of course, I want to say I'm no economic expert. I'm no expert on Iraq either. I just want to tell people what I saw and what I learned. But the economic situation, as I understand it, is really dire. I read a couple of weeks ago in the Guardian newspaper, which is a British newspaper, that unemployment is somewhere around 80%, which is phenomenal. So that obviously affects unemployed workers, but it affects the entire economy. If workers aren't employed, then they can't shop at the stores, and then that affects those sectors of the economy. And so, you know, all these things are interconnected. So we spoke, going back to our driver, Tarek, who drove us from Amman to Baghdad. He's both a driver and he runs kind of an internet cafe with his brothers, and he's saying that business is going down because people can't afford to do anything in Iraq. Another thing that's really important to note is that, like I said before, the public sector under Saddam's regime was very comprehensive, and the state had a lot of control over the economy. One of the aspects of control was rent control. And with the U.S. occupation, rent control is gone, and so a lot of people I met told me about how rent has skyrocketed. And the result is a lot of people are having to leave their homes. I didn't see with my own eyes people living on the street in Iraq, but I did hear about a lot of people squatting in bombed-out buildings. There's one building, what used to be the Ministry of the Air Force, which I saw, and it's a shell now because it was bombed out. And I'm told by independent journalists that there are 400 families squatting in there. So the situation is pretty bad as far as people being evicted from their homes because they can't afford rent, and so they're having to look elsewhere for places to live.
Corey, I'm concerned that if any bunker-busting bombs or other bombs using uranium munitions were used there, that those residents would be suffering from the toxicity of uranium, akin to the toxicity of lead paint, flaked and dispersed in the environment, and also this alpha radiation, if they're breathing in the dust of uranium weapons, that there's going to be harm caused by kidney stones, eventually lung cancers, genetic defects in offspring, and a long list of illnesses. So not only the immediate hardship of being homeless, but untold health consequences to come. We'll have to wait and see what develops. But if we can move to the point of organizing and what students are doing through the Campus Anti-War Network, I wonder if any of you are observing the anniversary of February 15th, when millions of people demonstrated worldwide last year, 2 million people out on the streets in London trying to prevent this catastrophe.
Right.
Have you heard about any students commemorating that great anniversary?
I haven't. There's been talk on the listserv about how there is a global vigil for peace on February 15th. And that's the extent of, in terms of actions, that people are taking on February 15th that I'm aware of.
What campaigns are you working on yourself?
I'm actually, myself and other activists in the Campus Anti-War Network are really working toward building demonstrations on March 20th. And this is the anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. There's been an International Day of Action called. And so we're working... Where I am in Rochester, we're organizing to get people down to New York City for the demonstrations there. I know that there are going to be demonstrations in New York, Chicago, and San Francisco, and other big cities in the United States as well. But this is something that we're really building toward, and it's really important. On February 15th, which was a really amazing day, it was actually the largest mobilization for a cause in world history. Never had so many people gathered on one day to organize around one issue, to take a stand. And the theme of February 15th was the world says no to war. And that was absolutely true. You had millions of people all around the world saying no to this U.S. invasion. The theme of the March 20th mobilization is the world still says no to war. And I think that it's really important for those of us who were there on February 15th, but a lot more other people are coming to realize just how bad this occupation is for Iraqi people and just how bad it is for us here in the United States. And it's really important for those of us who do feel this way to get active wherever we are. If you're on a campus, if you go to college or high school, I encourage you to check out the Campus Anti-War Network. Our website's campusantiwar.net. But wherever you are, I think we can plug in and be active against the occupation in some capacity. And the Trap Rock website is a great resource as well. That's traprockpeace.org. But to mobilize on March 20th, and for all of us to see for ourselves just how many people oppose the war, which I think is really important for us to know that we're not alone, that millions of people are with us, and that we can actually get together and do something. But it's important for us to show the world as well, to show people in this country, but to show people around the world that people here in the United States, the country that prosecuted the war, are actually opposed to it for humanitarian reasons, understanding how catastrophic it is for Iraqis, but also opposed to it because for most of us, this war isn't in our interest. And that's so crucial for us to show that. I mean, whenever I spoke with Iraqis, and they told me about how much their lives have changed since this occupation, how brutal it is and how much it's devastated their country and really how they're losing control of their lives. I was proud to tell them that there are a lot of people in the United States who are opposed to the occupation, and we're doing what we can where we are to put pressure on our government or this government to try to end it, to do what we can to end the occupation. So it's really important that those of us in the United States who are opposed to the occupation stand up and do what we can, be part of a discussion to figure out what we can do here to end it.
Curry Peterson-Smith of the Campus Anti-War Network, I'll give that website again. Curry, thank you for your kind words about traprockpeace.org. Please look for resources at campusantiwar.net. And I know there are important brochures and leaflets and flyers ready to download about the economics, the lies that people use to persecute the war, as you said. Any other resources you'd like to draw people's attention to, Curry?
The Occupation Watch Center, which, like I said, is based in Baghdad, and their web address is occupationwatch.org, one word. And they get articles together about the U.S. occupation of Iraq and have some reports on what's going on in the country. So that's a really good resource. They're doing great work.
thank you so much for sharing your time and for undertaking that arduous journey to Baghdad in January of 2004. Corey Peterson-Smith of the Campus Anti-War Network. I'm Sunny Miller at Trap Rock Peace Center. Thanks for being a part of this Neighbors Network to End War.
Thank you. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Corey.